Hello and welcome to the Risk Map podcast, part of the global conversation on geopolitics and security produced by Control Risks, the leading international risk consultancy. I'm Charles Hecker in London.
And in Washington, D.C., I'm Simon Whistler. Welcome to the podcast.
Don't let the accents fool you. Simon is in the U.S. and I'm based in London. Together, we're going to take you this week to Ecuador, Saudi Arabia, and Cameroon to look at some of the world's more interesting and relevant issues of risk for the coming fortnight.
In this day and age, for many of us, it's difficult to imagine life without the internet. But that's been the case in parts of Cameroon, where a three-month ban on the internet was just lifted. We'll talk to our Cameroon analyst, Vincent Rouget, to look into what happens next.
We'll also go to Ecuador, where a contentious election may have temporarily put a stop to left-wing electoral losses in South America.
But we'll start today's podcast in Saudi Arabia, where a recent government reshuffle has put more of the king's sons in leading government positions. Chuck spoke with our Saudi analyst, Graham Griffiths, who is just back from a trip to Jeddah.
Graham, tell us a little bit first about the trip. What kind of impressions have you brought back with you?
Thanks very much, Chuck. In the conversations that I had in both Jeddah and Riyadh, I sensed quite a bit of anxiety over the economic situation in the kingdom because of the continued low oil prices and the difficulties that the country's experienced. It's a tough period in the kingdom, both for businesses and for consumers. And of course, that economic anxiety is taking place in an environment of quite rapid and deep change as the government tries to push through the reforms associated with Vision 2030. And another thing I noticed was that I think there's a bit of discontent over the government's lack of communication regarding the vision. There's a sense that decisions are being made behind closed doors, that they're not being explained to the population, that people aren't being prepared for the types of changes that are coming or that have already occurred. There's also, I think, quite a bit of skepticism over the government's ability to kind of move forward with a number of pretty big legislative or regulatory initiatives. Those include the imposition of a value-added tax in the beginning of 2018, and supposedly this summer, a cash assistance program that's meant to gradually replace subsidies on things like gasoline, electricity, and water. And I think there's skepticism that, how smoothly those will be implemented or whether they'll be implemented on time. Funnily enough, however, I think that if I had gone back to Saudi Arabia this week or the week after, that the tone of those conversations would actually be quite different than the kind of skepticism and anxiety that I experienced when I was there.
Graham, is that because of the royal decrees that were issued over the weekend? I mean, tell us a little bit about the importance of those.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Saturday night, there was a flood of royal decrees that made several dozen of changes and appointments within the government. But the most important and kind of widely talked about was the one in which benefits and bonuses and allowances for public sector workers that had been cut back in the fall were restored. About two-thirds of Saudis who work for the government. And because of the way the civil service pay system has evolved, in a lot of cases, about 20 to 30% of people's salaries or take-home income comes from benefits because of the type of their work or certificates that they hold, things of that nature. And those are all canceled in the fall. So that was something that was resented by quite a large segment of the population. It was done overnight without a lot of forewarning. It represented a pretty big chunk of people's income. And that was something I heard constantly in my discussions as where the government had kind of stumbled on its implementation and communication over the vision. And so since the weekend, we've really seen that the mood has changed quite significantly. Lots of praise for the king and the government for taking this step, for rectifying what was seen as a mistake, and something that obviously people are quite excited about given the extra cash it's going to put in their pocket.
Graham, were there any other decrees that we should be paying attention to, any other decrees of note?
Yeah, we saw quite a large number of personnel shifts. Probably one of the most notable ones in terms of Saudi Arabia's international relations was the appointment of King Salman's son Khalid to be ambassador in D.C. I think that really emphasizes the importance that the Saudis are putting on renewing the relationship and their optimism for kind of reinvigorated relationship with the U.S. under the Trump administration to kind of try and forge a very personal connection by appointing the king's son to that position. We also saw the appointment of a lot of young princes from various parts of the family to positions in the provincial governments. And I think this is being seen as an attempt to inject new vibrancy into the government by putting young princes in positions that will prepare them to assume greater positions of leadership in the future. The other notable decree was the dismissal of the civil service minister Khalid Al-Arij and putting him under investigation for abusing his office because he appointed his son to a relatively high position in the ministry. This is being welcomed by segments of Saudi society as indicating a newfound commitment by the government to hold ministers accountable and prosecute them if they abuse the powers of their office. I'm a bit more cynical. I think this was more of an attempt to soak up some of the discontent that had been caused because of the pay cuts.
Graham, as always, we want to know what this means for the business community. Can you tell us a little bit about how businesses should interpret these recent developments?
Yeah, I think the continued appointment of a younger generation of both royals and technocrats to government positions shows that the government remains committed to the reform efforts that began last year with the announcement of Saudi Vision 2030. But it also shows that the path of reform is not a straight line. So, the government has committed to reducing expenditure on public sector salaries. And obviously, by restoring the old system, it's kind of walked back a bit along that line of reform. So, I think it shows that the government has to sometimes take a step backward and cater to public opinion in order to move forward with the broader reform effort. I think broadly, we can say that the country is moving in the right direction, but we do continue to see issues over the communication of policy and the effectiveness of implementation. And I think we're going to see some big tests for the government over the course of the next year with a couple of those programs that I mentioned.
Graham, that's a fantastic summary of your trip to Saudi Arabia. Graham Griffiths in Dubai, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In Ecuador, opposition candidate Guillermo Lasso continues to reject the results of the presidential second round runoff in early April. Although unrest over the elections appears now to have dissipated, political tensions are likely to remain as Lenin Moreno assumes the presidency. Ecuador's election also has symbolic value beyond its borders. With left-wing governments on the run across South America, has Moreno put an end to the losses on the left? Simon spoke to Laura Sharkey for more insight.
I'm joined now by Laura Sharkey, our Ecuador analyst. She's based in Bogota, but covers Ecuador from there. Laura, Lenin Moreno, he's been elected president now, and the opposition candidate Guillermo Lasso has seemed to have exhausted all his channels for contesting the election. So how has Moreno been able to buck the trend in Latin America, let's say, of the left losing a series of elections over the past couple of years?
Sure. I think, first of all, we should have a look at what Moreno actually proposed prior to the election, because that has quite a lot to do with the reasons why he was ultimately successful. Essentially, prior to the second round of elections, Moreno increased his own rhetoric related to some of the more popular aspects of his election campaign. So that's things related to job creation and also to public spending, whereas the other candidate, Guillermo Lasso, upped his own rhetoric related to austerity and the cuts required to ensure economic growth. And I think that scared a lot of voters who weren't potentially prepared for that sort of rhetoric. Also, I think it's important to say that we can't underestimate Correa's own influence. Correa has been one of the most popular presidents in Latin America over the few years, and to some extent this election was much more a referendum on Correa's own rule than it was about either of the two candidates. Lastly, I probably would warn here, the elections themselves were extremely closely contested, and the fact that we did obviously see such polarisation of the electorate perhaps hints at what's to come, and the fact that Moreno is not Correa and will face problems very particular to his own rule.
So you make reference to President Correa, and as you say, he's been a very popular and dominant figure in Ecuadorian politics over the last 10 years at least. So what's he going to do now? What's his role in Ecuador moving forward? Is he going to take a step back and let Moreno govern as he wants to?
Well, he said that he's going to take a step back, and he says that he's going to study in Europe. However, given his own personal influence within the AP party, the ruling party, I think that that is potentially a little bit too idealistic. Probably important to say here that Moreno lacks Correa's personal charisma that made him so popular. And I think that Moreno will face challenges keeping the AP alliance together without Correa. And I think that Correa will definitely have a role behind the scenes, and certainly the vice president, Jorge Glass, is pitted as much more of a hardline Correa-esque ruler. And so potentially the question there is not so much about Correa, but how much influence will Glass have, and will Moreno be able to stem some of that influence, especially as Glass has some of the more hardline supporters for Correa. So long story short, Moreno is popular himself, but he will face major challenges filling Correa's shoes, and Correa may even use that in future elections to come back to power, though he hasn't said that at this point.
So what can we expect in Ecuador over the next few years under a Moreno presidency in that context? It's not been an easy environment for business under Correa at many stages, with challenges for business of various sorts. Is there any prospects for improvements in the business environment these coming years?
I'd like to say yes. It's a good thing in some respects that we will see some policy continuity and there won't be an abrupt shift in policy making, which will elicit a sigh of relief from investors already in the country. But with that continuity will also come some of the challenges that investors have faced under the Correa regime. So, for example, investors often talk about dealing with corrupt officials, the fact that the ruling party has so much influence over all state institutions. And finally, the erraticness of the policy making that we've seen over the past few years under Correa, who has kind of prioritised social spending and social policies over policies that would improve the economy or encourage investors, and that just being very, very erratic and not following any real direction will unfortunately continue to see that. And finally, I think that we will likely see an increase in protests, in opposition to Moreno himself. Particularly for investors, it's important to say that we expect indigenous protests to increase as Moreno sees the kind of non-traditional sectors such as mining as the way forward to improve the economy. That will upset indigenous groups who've historically been sidelined by the government. And so I don't want this to sound like we're going to see all-out conflict, but Moreno will definitely face, and investors, more to the point, will face a more challenging environment than they might have done in recent years.
Interesting times ahead. Laura, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cameroon switched off the internet 3 months ago to crack down on political opposition in English language speaking parts of the country. Service has recently been restored, but what of the protests? How popular can any government be when it switches off what has come to be seen as a public utility? Vincent Rouget, our Cameroon analyst, explained.
Vincent, first give us a little bit of background about the social and political situation that led to the internet being cut off in Cameroon.
Hi, Chuck, and hi, everyone. Yeah, so Cameroon has seen a protest movement in the last 6 months in the English-speaking regions that really caught a lot of people by surprise. It started as a protest movement by lawyers and teachers around quite specific issues around their own professions, but really revived much deeper grievances around the role of and the place of the English-speaking regions of Cameroon in the broader system. Just to give a little bit of background, Cameroon is partly Anglophone, is about 15-20% Anglophone minority, but the political system is really dominated by a Francophone elite. And the Anglophones have long complained about feeling marginalized and being excluded or sidelined from power. And this issue really came to a head over the course of the last few months, with protests picking up demands for issues such as federalism, or even some people going as far as to demand secession of the English-speaking regions of Cameroon from the rest. The government hasn't budged at all, actually cracked down on protests in the last few months, and went as far as you said, Chuck, to suspending internet services in the affected regions for 3 months. And it was only last week that the service was restored. The protest movement was easing out. People were fatigued and largely stopped, you know, striking and going out in the streets, and the government deemed that now was the time to resume. But clearly, it shows, you know, a lot of tensions in these areas.
Vincent, we don't talk about Cameroon very often in the Risk Map podcast.
No, we don't,
and you don't see Cameroon very often in the international headlines. That's in part because it's generally considered a politically stable country. What's going to happen now?
Exactly. It rarely makes headlines simply because things don't really change, or at least don't seem to be changing very often. The president, Paul Biya, has been in power since 1982. He survived the end of the Cold War and in fact provided for remarkable political stability. It's a regime where you haven't seen a coup attempt or major unrest in recent years. But that stability is actually very much of a facade, and it belies a lot of divisions. The main factor in the meantime that assures stability is the role of the president, who's been there for so long. But there's a real risk that all these divisions could resurface when he leaves office, either when he dies, he's 83 years old, and the issue of his succession has been on the cards, or simply when he decides to step down from office. And we clearly, and it's something we've done a lot at Control Risk, encourage businesses to think through what a succession to Biya could look like and the potential it could create for further instability.
Vincent, this is a phenomenon that's happened not only in Cameroon, but in other parts of Africa as well. And we'll get to the whole notion of trying to live without the internet in a minute. But before that, this puts private sector companies in a difficult position because the cutoff of access to the internet is often forced on the private sector by the government.
Exactly.
in Cameroon and in other places around the continent. How has that played out?
So you're right to say it's an issue that's been becoming a lot more prominent over the last few years. Just last year, we've recorded around 10 countries where there's been partial or total suspensions of internet access. The reason for this is simply that social media has played an ever-growing role in protests. And more of these protests spring up and are picking up steam largely because of social media. And the instinctive reaction of governments has been to shut down access to WhatsApp or services such as Facebook or Twitter to try to nip these protests in the bud. Obviously, it's created a lot of challenges for companies. For example, in Cameroon, we've seen companies being forced to go back to CDs and USBs to store and communicate data. We've even seen local businesses trying to set up some internet refugee camps, you know, trying to find a hotspot where access was still available or traveling together to areas that still had connections. So it's obviously a major operational challenge. But the main victim of these four suspensions are the telecoms operators, obviously, because most of the time they get asked to comply with these directives. A phone call from important security officers asking them to suspend access or face license revocation. So they have little choice but to comply, which then exposes them to major reputational challenges because the reaction of the people when internet gets shut is to turn to operators and to ask them why are they complicit with censorship by the government and why don't they want to restore access. So it obviously requires a very cautious and careful communication on the part of companies that are asked to comply with that kind of directives. And also beyond the reputational challenges, it's financial losses. And losses that they have very little chance of ever being compensated for. So it's a very difficult issue that's likely going to become more and more prominent in the next few years for a lot of telecoms operators in Africa.
Vincent, it's morning while we're recording this podcast here in London, and you know, you walk into the office and you just switch your laptop on and the internet is there. And like me, you probably can't even count how many times this morning you've already used the internet. Exactly. It's just there. Can you bring us any other anecdotes from the situation in Cameroon and how almost 20% of the population there lived without social media, lived without the internet for all that time?
Well, the situation has been particularly damaging for the parts of Cameroon because it also happened to be one which has seen a thriving tech hub in the last few years. The town of Bouéa, in particular, in the southwest, was known from very active local entrepreneurs trying up a lot of startups in the tech industry. And these past 3 months without internet has been very difficult for them. And we're yet to see how they will cope with this and be able to resume their activities. It's been a challenge for all sorts of businesses. Obviously, banks had difficulties running normal services in ATMs. But a lot of our clients, just simply the day-to-day running of businesses get a lot more complicated when you have to drive 80 kilometers, 100 kilometers, 150 kilometers to get to the nearest point where you can get access.
Fascinating story. Vincent Rouget, thank you very much.
Before we sign off, here are a few other issues we're watching closely in the coming weeks. The immediate future brings a slate of interesting elections, and we're not even talking about France. By the way, our senior Europe analyst Dave Lee is discussing European elections in a separate podcast on our website. Have a listen.
On Thursday, the 4th of May, parliamentary elections will take place in Algeria. Turnout is likely to be low, and parties linked to the incumbent political military elite are likely to gain a majority.
And on Tuesday, 9th May, early presidential elections are taking place in South Korea following the formal impeachment of Park Ji-yoon-hae over allegations of corruption and abuse of power. Moon Jae-in from the opposition Liberal Democratic Party, a front-runner among likely presidential candidates and whose popularity has been growing steadily in recent months, is likely to win the presidency. While rallies are likely in the run-up to the presidential election, an escalation into large-scale violence is unlikely.
On Friday, the 19th of May, Iran holds its presidential election. Arrests are likely during the election period of reformist figures, as well as journalists and other individuals viewed with suspicion by the regime. However, there is unlikely to be significant street unrest because there's no popular appetite for risking the turmoil that may arise from challenging the regime. In our current assessment, the likely outcome will be the re-election of President Hassan Rouhani. We'll be looking at the Iranian elections more closely in an upcoming podcast.
But for now, that's it for the Risk Map podcast for the first half of May 2017. Find us every 2 weeks on Podbean, the Control Risk website, and iTunes. Thanks for listening. I'm Simon Whistler in Washington, D.C.
Simon, thanks for the co-hosting duties, and thank you to everyone who clicked and listened. From London, I'm Charles Hecker.